This is KUOW Seattle and The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for listening today and for joining us on Twitter at KUOW. 238 cities in the running to be the home of Amazon's new headquarters. And let's spin the big wheel. Ooh, is it going to be a free spin? No, it's past that. Okay, and the winner is somewhere else, as in not here. You know, some local cities had entered the sweepstakes, but today Amazon narrowed the list of HQ2 finalists down to 20 cities. And the prize for the winners or losers, depending on your point of view, the prize is said to be, 50,000 high-paying jobs, maybe a $5 billion investment. Let's dig in now with GeekWire's Todd Bishop and KUOW's Carolyn Adolph. Hi.
Hello.
Both of you watching this, and we figured, but now we know for sure, Amazon is not looking to double down in the Puget Sound area. Was there anything surprising about that?
Absolutely not. At the GeekWire event, Jeff Wilkie, who's the head of, worldwide sales at Amazon?
Consumer sales, yeah.
Consumer sales.
Consumer business.
Said, no way, it's not going to happen, wouldn't be prudent, and it didn't.
Hope you didn't spend too much money on your proposal, Tacoma, other regional cities.
You know, it's funny that that sound effect sounded a little bit like a slot machine, which I think is actually apropos. This, to me, was surprising for the sheer number of companies on the list. It was very much a long, short list. 20 companies.
Forgive me.
20 cities on this list was a big surprise.
Why?
Couldn't they have gotten it down to 10 or 5? I think it was surprising, and I think what's happening here is Amazon is setting things up to play these cities off of one another. And so they can say to Boston, for example, hey, New York has given us this. What you got? What can you bring to the table? And now that it's public, the identities of the cities, at least, they're in a better position to do that.
Why is that? Maybe they get their population is leaning on their leaders to, hey, let's be the winners and not the losers kind of thing?
That's got to play into it to a certain degree, although, of course, New York being New York, I'm not sure it'll be that interested.
Right.
It's just that it creates a hothouse atmosphere. A lot of the cities on this list really, really, really are delighted to be there and are in it to win it.
Mm-hmm. You could look at 20 cities and say, okay, we know this is part PR stunt anyway, but it's not even that's not a short list. That's just a keep talking about our ever-narrowing list.
Yes, and it's also a little bit more of a burlesque where they're going to be asked to show more than an ankle this time.
A burlesque, yes, well put. We should remind listeners what Amazon says it's looking for. What's it looking for?
It's looking for a variety of things, and you've obviously documented this thoroughly on Primed, one of my favorite podcasts. A big one is access to transportation, and for that reason, some of the cities on the list were a little bit of a head-scratcher. Talent pool.
Well, the talent pool is so critical, right? They need to be close to places that have universities that are, chucking out people that they want, that Amazon wants to hire highly qualified individuals. That points pretty heavily to the East Coast, especially since we're not seeing Silicon Valley on Amazon's list.
Absolutely. It was interesting. You had a few different clusters. One of them was the Keystone State, Pennsylvania, with Philadelphia and Pittsburgh both on the list.
Mm-hmm.
You had the Washington, D.C. area with Montgomery County, Northern Virginia, and Washington, D.C. itself. And then you had the New York, New Jersey with both Newark and New York City on the list, which I think indicates strongly to me at least their geographic presence or preference.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
I remember International Airport being on the list, but I haven't flown internationally from Columbus, Ohio, so I was surprised to see Columbus land on that. Nashville, Raleigh, North Carolina, Austin, Texas.
Ah, but Atlanta, the largest airport in the country.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. The big surprise in my mind was Los Angeles. What the heck, Los Angeles? I think there are two cities on this list of 20 that are essentially window dressing. Los Angeles is one. It ensures that the headline today was not Amazon snubs. The West Coast.
Yeah.
And Toronto, which I know is a front runner in some minds. I've evolved my thinking on that. I think that it was also there, Toronto, to say, hey, this was not a U.S.-only search.
Uh-huh.
Except that Toronto has a low-drama immigration system.
That is the big strength.
What do you mean low-drama immigration system?
Well, it's been in a stable state for a while. We don't have countries that are on lists and off lists.
Mm.
So that really helps Amazon have some amount of predictability in its relationship with government as they procure great scads of their workforce from abroad.
Absolutely. And the issue with Toronto, though, is that Google, through a subsidiary called Sidewalk Labs, is already working with the city government there. And if there's one characteristic of Amazon that stays true, it's they don't like to be a follower, not even to be perceived as a follower. So I could see where that would cause some issues for Toronto, because if Amazon went there, they would, by some people, be seen as following in Google's footsteps.
We've talked a bit about PR and window dressing, but of course, a huge factor in all of this is quote unquote incentives, tax breaks and all that stuff. So do we know anything about how these 20 cities sweetened the deal and offered to cut taxes or boost incentives for Amazon?
We only have a partial picture. I mean, one of the great mysteries to me is to see Indianapolis on the list of 20 today. Now, we don't know what Indianapolis promised, but we also don't know why it's on the list.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one big mystery.
Yeah. If you look at New Jersey in particular, they did pledge about $5 billion in tax breaks, which is on the level of what Amazon says the overall economic impact of the construction of this campus will be, how much they'll spend on developing the campus. So clearly New Jersey pulled out all the stops, and I could see New Jersey being on the list primarily because it's a bargaining chip.
Mm. Here's a question of interest to us listening right now in the Seattle area. Are there any of these cities on this list of 20 that you could look at and say, oh, if Amazon went there, that wouldn't just be HQ2. That wouldn't just be another headquarters. That could become the future headquarters that sucks the jobs away from the Seattle area.
I think that the fact that Jeff Bezos has a home in the Washington, D.C. area, a second home, really makes that triangle, that triumvirate of bids from that area very interesting.
It was D.C., a county in Maryland.
Yes.
And Northern Virginia.
Exactly.
Yes.
And so I think that could be something. I don't know that that would be a big appeal to Amazon workers compared to Seattle, although you do have the easy access on the Amtrak to the Northeast Corridor, all the way from Boston to Philadelphia if you're in D.C. I think, to me, the cool places on this list are Austin and Toronto if you're looking to attract talented young engineers, people who might look for the urban hip factor in those cities.
So those are cool cities. What city to you is most unlike Seattle in some important way? For example, I could imagine a city that doesn't have much. We have a lot of tech infrastructure here, and we've got the UW Computer Science Department and the Paul Allen Artificial Intelligence Institute. Like, there's a lot going on tech-wise. Were there any of these cities that you think, man, that would just transform that place if Amazon wanted to invest 50,000 jobs there?
I mean, Philadelphia has great bones, but it...
Great bones.
It does have its marvelous bones, and it's in the right place because it's on the eastern seaboard and it's not heavily, it's ripe for urban renewal, but it's, it isn't heavily established as a tech hub. It is a tech hub, but you could build on it. So that is the one that I think is the sort of one of the most exciting prospects. And also, there are some other reasons to look at that area because Jeff Wilkie is from that corner of the country. And so maybe that's a way that the Amazon leadership would choose to, establish itself. And Pittsburgh's out there too.
Yes, and actually Wilkie is from Pennsylvania and originally from Pittsburgh and has that sort of warehousing and manufacturing background very much in his DNA. This is the Amazon consumer executive who wears the flannel shirts every day in the fourth quarter and as an homage to Amazon's warehouse and distribution workers. The Amazon CFO has roots in Pittsburgh and parts of Pennsylvania as well. I think it's hard to ignore those. In terms of just the diametrically opposed, I mean, it's hard to get any different from Seattle than Miami, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, it's literally on the other corner of the country. I think one challenge there is, frankly, that flight is brutal. As I have a brother-in-law who lives down there, and man, I would not wish that on anybody.
So. You feel all six of those hours or whatever
exactly.
It is.
Exactly.
any just head scratchers on the list?
Well, I mean, there are a few head scratchers. Why are there so many way south of DC potential destinations still there? And this, when you start looking at the southern states, these are right-to-work states. It's a different context than they've experienced in Seattle. And to me, it has echoes of Boeing and the loss of the 787 line, which is a sort of a continual pull toward Charleston. And it's so to me, there's a little bit of a resonance there that when you exit Seattle, it just feels a little bit more of an exit somehow if you pull it there.
Well, what is the union factor in Seattle with Amazon? What do unions have to do with Amazon?
I guess it's really about just a tone and a context. You also see huge incentives being given out in the South to draw in new business.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yep. At this point, tech unions aren't a factor for Amazon, but I could see where that could be one consideration as they're talking about the potential workforce. If it is in a place that is decidedly pro-union, that could be a hurdle for whatever community that is, for better or for worse. Jeff Bezos, with his libertarian leanings, and in the tech industry in general, they have very much stayed away from unions.
Is there anything more to say about whether this HQ2 becomes HQ1? We were talking a little about the human element in all of this.
We've been talking about a theory at GeekWire today that to fully legitimize this as Amazon's full equal second headquarters, as they originally pitched, the surefire way of doing that would be to have Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos stay there and essentially primarily work there. If you send out one of the other CEOs, Andy Jassy from AWS, or Jeff Wilkie, the CEO of the consumer business, who we've been talking about, there's a risk that it could be perceived as a satellite office, which they very specifically are not doing here.
Why? Why do they care whether there's a satellite office?
Well,
versus a co-equal.
You know, that's a great question. They have been adamant, though, in saying HQ2 is an HQ. The HQ in HQ2 is not a misnomer, according to Amazon.
Full equal.
Yes. The phrase. Is that even grammatical? I'm not sure.
I don't know.
Yeah, I know, but that's the quote that they use. I think it is a fully, they want to make it a fully equal.
Uh-huh.
I'm on NPR. I gotta be careful
grammar.
So I think the surefire way to do that is Washington, D.C., and that would allow Jeff Bezos to essentially hang out there primarily.
If I imagine Amazon thinking of the workplace of the future having as little as possible to do with geography and who lives where and who goes to what airport. But I mean, geez, if the point isn't that you can have a meeting without flying, what is the point of the technology that we're all giddy about?
I suppose that's true, but maybe Jeff Bezos is finally looking to maybe redeploy some of his rockets to completely close down the distance.
Yes.
The temporal distance between Seattle but aside from that, I mean, but the thing is, these are still human beings who are going to have to sit in planes, and there has to be a certain amount of going back and forth. So if you're the world's richest man or somebody who's approaching that on the list, how much of that do you really want to do? How much of that would actually be effective use of your time and energy?
Mm-hmm. I think it's important also to note that Amazon has, as they readily acknowledge, a peculiar culture. Their catchphrase internally is "be peculiar."
Mm-hmm.
And it's a bit
keep
of
keep Seattle weird.
It's similar. exactly. It's a bit of a tenuous thing to do if someone is starting remotely. And so I think they do need a physical place somewhere else. And the other thing on that is this new workforce at HQ2 may not be entirely human.
Right. Right.
Yes.
Amazon, as many KUOW listeners know, they are full on in robotics. It is key. And frankly, that's something that gives Pittsburgh a leg up with Carnegie Mellon and the Robotics Institute there, which I don't think has gotten on a lot of people's radar, but that gives Pittsburgh an edge.
Final question. It's 25 years ago, and bizarro Jeff Bezos is driving cross country from Seattle to New York instead of the other way around and founds Amazon there instead of here. Okay, so HQ1 is in New York. Would Seattle be on Amazon's short list of 20 cities for HQ2?
Wow, well, in this fictional view of the past, did Seattle also pass the Commons?
Uh-huh.
That would
the
have
famous
taken,
Lake, take, South Lake Union Park that which, never happened?
Which would have taken that whole headquarters campus. I think if that was available still today to build up, I think the answer is yes.
I wonder, I mean, the HQ2 proposal says we're looking for cities who would be excited to have us. In your reverse universe, would Seattle have been excited?
Good question. Carolyn Adolph, she co-hosts the KUOW podcast, Primed. What is it? What's the catchphrase? What happens when Amazon comes to your town? And do you have a catchphrase at GeekWire, Todd Bishop?
Yeah, Seattle tech news from the perspective of the world, you know. That's really how we look at things.
Catchy.
Love it.
Catchy.
In the reverse, the world from the perspective of Seattle.
Todd Bishop, Carolyn Adolph, thanks for considering HQ20.
Thanks, Bill.
It's KUW's The Record. Back in a moment. It's KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. When I was a kid, I thought I knew who my parents were. They were the adults. They told me what to do. Now that I'm a grown-up, my idea of my parents is more complicated. I want to talk with our poetry correspondent about this, because Elizabeth Austin has brought us a poem from that world. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hey, Bill.
What have you brought us?
Well, I'm always drawn to poems that respond in some way to children's relationships with their parents.
You are?
I am. I just think they get more layered the older we get.
Mm-hmm.
So this is by a local poet named Kevin Kraft, and it's from his second collection of poems called Vagrants and Accidentals.
And we want to listen closely because, like any good poem, it reveals itself, it turns. Will you set this up for us?
Yeah. So in one way, the poem is set on the boardwalk in Ocean City, New Jersey. But in another sense, this is a cinematic view of a woman in the second half of the 20th century from her son's perspective as an adult. So here's Kevin Kraft with Matinee.
Matinee. She is one moving over the boardwalk. My mother in Ocean City, New Jersey. Crossbeam hammered and hovering above the dune line. Boardwalk cracking like an exhumed spine. So much love does she have for it walking, the boards has become her life's work, measuring out the wooden miles like stalking her own horizon, summer after summer, climbing down the gray-green ladder of the Atlantic, only to climb back up again, every plank a sleeper, every nail a fraction of that solitude named for the beach end of the road, 12th Street, 13th, the music pier floating over breakers like an ark. But who is alone walking on a boardwalk, if not my mother, in winter, gauging the distance between storms and the hours she has to make it through childhood and back again, hers awash in sistering, the small tasks of being eldest among six, three in a room, one big bed, born into a boom she can't escape. I know her by the broad-brimmed hat, the trail of gulls, and the easy way she lifts me from the splinter in my foot or finds me somewhere in her 20s, sitting on a bench, waiting if not wailing through a blank day lost and found. What do I know about difficulty then, except what I glean from late-night arguments in the kitchen? My mother driving to work and my father chain-smoking at the end of the driveway. Never mind the hopeless weeping she all but buries herself inside that summer Christopher was lifted, blue and lifeless, from the bottom of the pool. The Atlantic has nothing on her, pounding out its names for a erasure, emptiness and fullness, the same calamity, underwriting now the doo-wop band, now the high school prom and string quartet, drawing the Sanderlings into its sheen, chasing them aside. Through Cold War backwash and every season of the Ferris wheel, she walks as if the boards depended on it, the hardwood opening to her tender instep, so many breaks collecting in her stride.
Again, that's local writer Kevin Kraft reading Matinee from his poetry collection Vagrants and Accidentals. And yes, we're going to talk about the gut punch in that poem. But first, Elizabeth Austin, you talked with Kevin Kraft. What did you want to know after hearing that poem?
Well, I was curious about an image right in the middle of the poem where Kevin writes, "She lifts me from the splinter in my foot or finds me somewhere in her 20s sitting on a bench, waiting, if not wailing, through a blank day lost and found." And he told me that that image of being lifted off the splinter is a metaphor for being adopted. I love how he's turned that around. We would usually talk about removing a splinter, not lifting the child from the splinter.
Right.
But Kevin also told me that he discovered something about his mom as her own person in the world. He told me that she got married right out of high school and took a job at an insurance company, even though her husband, Kevin's dad, expected her to be a housewife.
One of my early memories is a sticker on our front door that said, "Feminism spoken here." And I sort of grew up proud to associate myself with feminism, that I thought that that was the strong, vital, forward-moving political energy in America. And it made sense in our family because my mom was discovering her freedom, growing into things she was never allowed to think about being up until the mid-60s, you know, from high school into marriage. And so the poem really sort of opened that trajectory up, not just for my mother, but it gave me a sense how my mother's life really kind of tracked American culture from the post-war through that very volatile era.
That's writer Kevin Kraft talking about the poem we heard a moment ago, Matinee. Elizabeth, what did he tell you about that image in the poem of the drowned child? Christopher was lifted blue and lifeless from the bottom of the pool.
Yes, that refers to Kevin's little brother. And here's how Kevin described that event and how it upended their family.
My earliest memories are associated with my three siblings, the four of us and our family, camping, going to the beach, doing all those things that middle Americans, white middle Americans in the 70s could do. And then my brother died. It was a terrible accident. He went into the pool when he wasn't supposed to. He thought he had a floaty, but it had a hole in it. And my brother, my other brother, I'm the oldest, and then there's Tom. Tom discovered Chris and came running in. I have a vivid memory of it, and it just rippled through our house. And my dad leapt up and tried to save him, and it was a very difficult time, and the neighborhood sort of pulled together around our family, but it was really the beginning of the end of my parents' marriage, which was a little turbulent. My mom and discovering feminism and working for the first time in a women's crisis center, and that did not please my father, who wanted a traditional male working role, and they fought a lot about that a lot. But it was really the death of the brother that sort of really splintered. Okay, we can't hold this together anymore. It didn't happen right away, but that shock lived with us for a while.
So, Bill, after that image of his brother Christopher drowned in the pool, Kevin gives us this image again of his mom walking that boardwalk. He writes, "The Atlantic has nothing on her, pounding out its names for erasure. Emptiness and fullness, the same calamity." I think what I appreciate about what Kevin accomplishes in this poem is how much of a life he does compress into this poem. I do feel like I have a sense of the great arc, the depths, and also the continuity of his mother's life as a person separate from him. I think that can be a hard thing to do, writing about your own parent.
And Elizabeth, does Kevin have his own children now?
He does. He does. He writes about his adopted daughter in other poems, in Vagrants and Accidentals. And, you know, he had this to say about how his understanding of his mom's life affects how he tries to parent his daughter.
"The gift that my mother gave me was a sensitivity to the difficult trajectory that women have had in our culture and in our society. And a desire to see that my daughter grows up strong and benefits from that struggle, doesn't forsake those gains, but takes them and builds upon them. And I think that's my most important mission as a father right now. My daughter is 12, going on 17, and has plenty of strength in her. Sometimes it's just a matter of channeling it in the right direction, or just letting her be herself and discover herself. That's a privilege that my mom did not get until later in life. But I want to make sure that my daughter has from the earliest moments."
That's one local writer reflecting on the mother he knew, the mother he didn't know, the parent he's trying to be now. That's Kevin Kraft. He read us the poem Matinee from his collection, Vagrants and Accidentals. And it's our poetry correspondent who brought that to us. And Elizabeth Austin, I enjoyed that in your conversation with Kevin Kraft. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome, Bill.
Last month, Amtrak Cascades 501 derailed on its inaugural trip from Seattle to Portland. Three people died when the train plunged over a bridge onto a highway in Pierce County. Almost 100 more people were hurt. Amtrak has promised to pay all the bills for cleanup and medical expenses, but that's not what happened in 2015.
Breaking news, a fatal train derailment in the city of Philadelphia. An Amtrak train with 243 people on board went off the rails. Five people dead tonight, and at least 130 people were taken to hospitals in the area, six of them critically injured.
And those numbers eventually would rise to eight people dead, more than 200 injured. My next guest was on that train. Josh Gottbaum is a guest scholar at the Brookings Institute. He has spent his career working on disaster response and relief. And he wrote a piece for The Washington Post called I Survived an Amtrak Crash. This week's victims are in for a rude awakening. Josh Gottbaum, welcome to KUOW.
Glad to be here.
What were you doing on that train that day?
Well, it was 9:30 at night, so I was doing what any self-respecting workaholic would do. I was sending emails.
When did you first know something was wrong?
First, you heard this really loud screech. And so I looked up and realized that the car was turning. So the screech was from the brakes, and we were on a turn. And the train was falling on its side, going off the tracks. My first thought was, we just left Philadelphia. We're near the river. Are we going into the river, et cetera? And then we went off the track. The lights went out. The train went through the dirt on its side. The windows popped out. The car was full of dust. And the seats came off the floor because of the force. And so everybody was thrown. I was kind of lucky. Me and the person next to me were kind of covered by seats. The woman behind me was crushed by her seat, and the guy two rows in front of me was thrown from the car and killed. So the first reaction was, am I dead? And then I realized probably not. And then the question is, anything broken? I didn't think so. And so then we just we were in the car. The car was on its side. The seats were in piles. It was completely dark. And people started looking for their luggage and trying to figure out how to get out. And fortunately, since we were in the middle of the car, we couldn't go off the end because you couldn't – it's hard to walk down the aisle when there's no aisle and the car is on its side. But an enterprising guy who was in much better shape than me climbed up on a pile of seats, pushed out the window that was on the other side, which was now the roof, pulled himself up, and so we were able to help people out of the car by pushing them up a pile of seats, and then he would pull them up onto the top of the car, and at that point the police came. And it was scary in part because people were woman, a row in front of me, her arm was deeply gashed, another was broken, and a fire started under the car. And so I was afraid that we were all going to just be asphyxiated by the fire or burned up or whatever. But so it was terrifying, but short-term terrifying.
You said you wondered how hurt you were. What were your injuries?
It turned out that I had broken ribs. I had scratched corneas. Couple of other bruises, and that my knee had been jammed by the accident. I had a knee that was arthritic but working okay, and the accident kind of pushed the bones together. So now, a couple of years later, I have repaired ribs, my eyes have healed, and I have a new knee.
What did you
consider myself pretty lucky.
Pretty lucky, yeah, I hear that. What did you want from Amtrak?
Oh, well, what I would have liked was a prioritization of safety in the first place. I ran Hawaiian Airlines for 2 years, and in the airline industry, safety is a priority, both because the airlines want to do it and because the FAA requires it. So they prioritize safety. They try to make things safe. Amtrak, by comparison, had a safety system called positive train control that they had installed but had not turned on in Philadelphia because legally they weren't required to turn it on until the end of the year. So if the accident had happened 8 months later, it wouldn't have happened. Similarly, at Cascade 501, the track had the safety system installed.
This is the derailment in Pierce County.
Yes.
Yes, yeah. Here. Mm-hmm.
However, Amtrak hadn't put on a train that had the system installed in it because they didn't have to do it till next year. So the first thing I would have liked is prioritization of safety, in which case the accident wouldn't have happened. But once the accident does happen, then what you want is preparation and compassion, and they just didn't do it. When the police and the fire and the folks in Philadelphia were great, they got us off the train. They got us in the yard. They got us to hospitals where we were checked, et cetera. But I was in Jefferson Hospital in Philly for 6 hours before I met anyone from Amtrak. And that person said, my job is just to put you in a cab to 30th Street Station and somebody there will tell you what's going on. That turned out not to be true because they hadn't prepared. So they had a very nice person in the train station who passed out a form that they had just developed. They had not prepared for this at all. So one thing I would have liked is prioritization. Second thing that would have been nice is a little compassion. The third thing, which I did write about in the Washington Post, is that the Congress of the United States, in its infinite lack of wisdom, not only didn't require Amtrak to put on safety systems, but it also limited the compensation that Amtrak would have to pay people for the damages they went through. Their lives were disrupted, their lives were lost, et cetera. And so there was a long judicial process. The CEO of Amtrak said, we're taking full responsibility, and that just plain wasn't true.
How much money were you looking for?
There was a process to figure out what people lost in terms of income and medical expenses, et cetera. And that was a very careful and very professionally done process. It was done under court order by two judges. And so in everybody's case, they said, we think your damages are this, or we think your damages are that, et cetera. However, Congress put a cap on the total that Amtrak would be required to pay. So as a result, what the judges decided people's damages were was not what they got. They got a fraction of it.
Do you mind telling us your personal numbers, or would you rather not?
I cannot. As a legal matter, in order to join this process, I had to agree to make not to disclose any of the details of it.
Really? Why is that?
I don't know, but my suspicion, as I say, the great frustration here is that Amtrak publicly announces to the world and holds press conferences and makes statements and says, we are going to be fully responsible. And then they run a process which is not responsible. And so part of the reason why I wrote the article in the Post is that it's too late for the victims of Cascade 501 to have prevented the accident, which Amtrak could have done just by turning on the safety system. But it's not too late for them to be adequately compensated for whatever their losses are, their damages, their medical expenses, their loss of wages, et cetera. But that's going to take the Congress of the United States not only not shutting itself down at the end of this week, but changing the law.
Well, it's been almost 3 years since your derailment in Philadelphia. As I said, Amtrak pledged to pay all the cleanup and medical expenses for our derailment near Tacoma. And what do you expect the victims in Pierce County will actually receive in comparison to what they're what they're being promised?
What happens is Congress passed a cap of $200 million, which is the maximum that a passenger or a railroad has to pay if in any particular accident. So if the combined losses of the families of the three people who died and the more than 100 people who had medical expenses and lost wages and whatever, et cetera, are more than $200 million, then guess what? They're not going to – then Amtrak is not going to fully put them back to where they were as if they could. And my view is that's a shame. It shouldn't be that way.
We're talking with Josh Gottbaum, who's with the Brookings Institute, but also you have personal experience with disaster prevention response. You ran Hawaiian Airlines. If you were running Amtrak, what would you change?
Oh, a lot of things. One is there's a federal agency that reviews disasters. It's called the National Transportation Safety Board. They're very professional. They work really hard. And one of the things they have repeatedly said about Amtrak is that Amtrak does not have a safety culture, that it's not the first priority. And I'll tell you from having worked with the people at Hawaiian Airlines, they have a safety culture. They are very professional. And so one thing is just making it a priority. One of the reasons I'm hopeful is that the former chief executive of Delta Airlines, Richard Anderson, is now the co-chief executive of Amtrak. So I'm hoping that he'll take even a little bit of the professionalism and the safety consciousness that there is in the airline industry and give it to Amtrak. It would be nice to prioritize that. It would also be nice if they, like the airline industry, if they practiced responding to disasters and practiced the kind of compassion that they don't seem to have. I also ran an agency called the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, which pays people's pensions when companies go bankrupt. And so people are not generally happy to deal with the PBGC. The folks at PBGC are really professional. They deliver pension checks without a hitch to, you know, several million people. But from time to time, they make mistakes. So what happens when they made a mistake? The answer is they admitted it and they made it right. They apologized. I signed personally, you know, thousands of letters of apology, and they compensated people for what their actual damages were. That's the second piece of what I'd like to see from Amtrak. I'd like to see more professionalism. I'd like to see prioritization of safety. And I'd like to see the kind of compassion and concern from our national railroad that we get from our national airlines.
In your experience, Josh, what makes a big transportation company, an airline, a railroad, what makes that company more compassionate or less compassionate and accountable? Is it how much legislation or shareholders or the human being at the helm?
I think it all matters. I will tell you that when I came to Hawaiian Airlines, I didn't need to tell those folks to be compassionate. They were great. They are great, et cetera. And partly over years and years and years, folks have worked to improve their sensitivity to customers. They recognize that people could fly a different airline. They treat them like people. They work hard. Amtrak apparently works on the theory that folks are captive. And so I'm hoping that over time, and it doesn't happen immediately, but I'm hoping that over time, the new management at Amtrak will make both safety as a priority and compassion as a priority. I'll tell you one other story. I used to be an investment banker and had as a client the guy who ran British Airways. And British Airways started as a government agency and then became a private company. And what the chief executive, his name was Colin Marshall, did is he said, we are now in a world in which We have to be competitive. We have to treat people like customers. And so he sent everybody at British Airways to customer training. Everybody. And that's the kind of priority that it would be nice to see.
Josh, two more questions, please. Number one, what is your advice to victims of the Pierce County derailment, the loved ones, and as we said, 100 or so people hurt?
One is, my heart goes out to you all. I've actually had a couple of conversations with a couple of folks because of my experience. It is, my first piece of advice is, take care of yourself and recognize that just because you are you're off the train, that you can't, that you must make still be shaken up. And so take care of yourself. Pay attention. Tell your family members to give you a little room, because it really does change how you deal with people. Second thing is, if you have been damaged and your life has been disrupted, interview some lawyers and find someone who is also compassionate and also professional, who can represent you and make sure that they do for you the best that can be done for you. So first talk to your family members, then talk to a lawyer.
Finally, Josh, you still take Amtrak. Why is that?
Because it's still the safest way to get from two places. I used to tell people that when I was at one point, I got a pilot's license myself, and I flew. And I said, flying on a commercial airline, and it's true for Amtrak, the greatest danger you're in is when you're driving to the station. Amtrak is still safer by far than me driving from here to New York or whatever, et cetera. And most of the time, they're fine. It's in the unusual circumstances that test folks' souls, and that's those unusual circumstances that I hope that Richard Anderson, the new co-CEO of Amtrak, will help improve.
Scholar and economist Joshua Gottbaum survived the Amtrak 188 derailment in Philadelphia almost 3 years ago. Used to run a transportation company himself, Hawaiian Airlines, and we are tweeting out a link to his piece called "I Survived an Amtrak Crash. This Week's Victims Are in for a Rude Awakening," in reference to the Pierce County derailment that happened last month. Josh, good to talk with you. Thank you for this.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Take care.
You too. You can read about that at KUOW. We're tweeting out a link to that piece, at KUOW. Thanks for tuning in. By the way, Amtrak, of course, we reached out to Amtrak for comment, and they said that their family assistance work had been reviewed by the National Transportation Safety Board for the Philadelphia derailment, and that their work in the Cascades derailment here is ongoing. The city of Seattle has promised to reduce its carbon footprint substantially, but it's falling short of its targets, well short. We're finding out why and what could change. Now, there's another city that also wants to slash greenhouse gas emissions. In Oslo, Norway, cars are the biggest carbon emitters, just like here in Seattle. But Oslo is taking bolder steps, like removing vast swaths of on-street parking downtown. Could that happen here? KUOW's David Hyde takes a look.
On-street parking rates are up to nearly $5 an hour in some parts of Seattle. It's a variable rate mostly designed to meet parking demand throughout the day. But parking is also part of a bigger plan to reduce Seattle's carbon footprint.
There's a really direct connection between, you know, what we're trying to do on the transit front and even the parking front and the city's climate change goals.
Andrew Glass Hastings is the Transit and Mobility Director for the City of Seattle. And he says, on top of higher parking prices, drivers now have to vie for fewer spots, carving out more space on the streets for commuters and shoppers.
Instead of storing a private automobile in that public right-of-way all day, we're now able to use it in a way where potentially thousands of people are getting on and off a bus.
More people are now taking mass transit, and that's partly due to higher parking prices.
Every dollar that somebody spends on transportation is a dollar they don't have to spend on housing or other costs.
And there's tension at the heart of city policy between saving the environment and keeping costs down for low-wage workers, like Worknesh Lakeview, who currently has to drive into downtown Seattle for her job.
Because I work so early, starting like 5:30, and there's no bus. That's why I'm driving.
Lakeview's a server at the Seattle Hilton, where she's worked for nearly two decades. So why not just live closer to work?
I used to live in Seattle, Beacon Hill, but now I live a little far away because this is too expensive.
Lakeview now commutes from Kent, and it's expensive. There's gas, insurance, and the cost of parking just keeps going up.
It is double. It's like $200 a month.
And Lakeview says that cost is a major burden for her and for most of her coworkers, and on-street parking is now completely out of reach. But here's the thing. Cars are still the biggest source of greenhouse gas emissions in Seattle, and under its current climate action plan, Seattle needs to reduce carbon dioxide emissions from transportation 15 times faster than it's currently doing. So does that mean more radical changes are needed? In Oslo, Norway, they're taking the concept one step further, phasing out on-street parking in their downtown core. Here's Oslo's mayor Marion Borgen describing what fewer cars could mean.
We will have more space for pedestrians, for children, for bicyclists, and we will also reduce the pollution that we have in the air.
I ask University of Washington traffic engineer Mark Hallenbeck about that, and he is adamant. Seattle should not go down the same road as Oslo.
Great, removing parking might have an environmental benefit, but the backlash from it might be so bad
that drivers will be up in arms, and they'll punish elected officials for it. But Hallenbeck admits there may be a case for phasing out on-street parking in parts of Seattle, if it means a better future with more options and more transit mobility.
Do I get bus lanes? Bus rapid transit that actually moves and isn't stuck. And you'll get way more people in the bus because people can zoom through the city on that bus.
In other words, fewer on-street parking spaces would make it a lot easier for everyone to get around, including drivers. And it would get Seattle closer to actually keeping its promises when it comes to climate change. In Seattle, I'm David Hyde, KUOW News.
And this is part of our series, The Burning Question, which gets at something our listeners asked us. What would a climate-friendly Seattle actually look like? And reporter David Hyde is in the studio with me now. Hey, David.
Hey, Bill.
So you just told us about Oslo. Thank you. Why is it comparable to Seattle?
There's a lot of similarities, actually. The population size is similar. Oslo's also got a lot of hills, apparently. I've not been there. Norway itself is a car country. The bike czar for the city of Oslo told me that they love their cars in Norway.
They love their cars. See, that's not obvious to me. I've heard so many stories about Scandinavian paradise. I thought maybe they were, you know, bike pedaling.
Just on trams.
Yeah, on
everywhere.
Trams. Yeah. Eco-idealists. But they love their cars in Oslo.
They do. Also, politically, the city of Oslo is this kind of left-wing oasis in a right-wing controlled country.
Yeah.
Sounds at all familiar.
Right, right. And what about climate change? How similar are we there?
Similar in the sense that both cities are relatively ambitious for their countries, but Oslo is a lot more ambitious than Seattle is. Seattle is shooting to be carbon neutral by 2050, and Oslo says, we're going to get that done 20 years sooner.
2030, that's getting very close. How does Oslo plan to pull that off?
They've got a whole bunch of ideas, just like the city of Seattle. They've slapped tolls, in their case, on cars entering the city. They want to phase out fossil fuel use for all heating, so that would be residential as well as commercial, other government buildings, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. They want their bus fleets to be powered entirely by renewable energy, and we benefit from a lot of renewables here, too. Mm-hmm. And they're also just building bike lanes like crazy, including dedicated bike lanes.
And
I actually have a sort of a breaking news update related to that. I was reading
breaking Oslo news
that I was able to read through Google Translate this morning. Uh-huh. They're going to increase the number of bike lanes from 180 to 530 kilometers. So this is a lot.
That's a lot of bike lanes, and so that is, and they're doing that by reducing parking, like you were just telling us about?
Exactly. And unlike Seattle in some ways, it's an older city, right? It's extremely dense. And so if you want to carve out space for bike lanes, there's only one easy way to do it, which is to remove parking and sort of make that possible, especially in their downtown core.
And where is Seattle on that question?
Seattle's also looking at the issue of parking. It's a part of our overall transit planning, which is a part of our climate solutions here in Seattle. Prices for parking are going up. It's up to $5 an hour, as I said in the story. Mm-hmm. Obviously, some people aren't going to be able to drive downtown and afford that as much as they used to. So that'll sort of limit the number of drivers. But the larger picture here is carving out space to make it possible for more things to happen, like bike lanes.
And the reason not to do that is what? Why isn't Seattle forging ahead like that?
I think it could have something to do with politics. If you look at the issue of parking in Seattle over the last few years, you know, it's the war on cars, it's the war on parking. Mm-hmm. Drivers like their parking spots, including their free parking spots. So if you talk about removing parking, you make that a part of your public policy, it can be relatively unpopular. But, you know, the larger question is, what do people get in return for that?
Well, in Oslo, it sounds like, even though they love their cars, they're forging ahead. I don't know, maybe they don't have a translation for war on cars in Norwegian, but...
That could be it. If they did, I wouldn't be able to say it.
How do they feel in Oslo about these questions from outsiders about, what are you doing with climate change?
Yeah, so I asked the bike czar about that, and she told me it's just depressing.
The depressing
idea that Oslo is a model for the world.
Why is that depressing?
Depressing because she's like, what the heck is going on in the rest of the world if we're the model?
Oh, okay. That's a dose of reality. David Hyde, a reporter on this series of ours, The Burning Question, what would a climate-friendly Seattle actually look like? David, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Bill.
It's The Record on KUOW, put together by Amina Al-Sadi, Ajua Jimabrempong, Bon Huberman, Jason Pagano. I'm Bill Radke. You'll find our series, The Burning Question, at KUOW.org. Thanks for listening.